That I would speak to Stannis, though I doubt my words will sway him. A king's first duty is to defend the realm, and Mance attacked it. His grace is not like to forget that. My father used to say that Stannis Baratheon was a just man. No one has ever said he was forgiving.
Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast.
Originally founded in 2010, as two champs and a chum, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and the world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community.
This is Season 12 of the White Book Podcast.
Good John quote.
Indeed. Feast for Crows. Really, really digging for different Baratheon quotes at this point.
Yeah, there aren't that many. Like, there's not that many Davos chapters. And then, of course, I mean, I guess there's a lot of Stannis in the fifth book. There's a lot of Stannis. But I think that's kind of the most Stannis, the Manus that we get.
Maybe?
Because I remember...
Unless three is, but I'm not sure.
I don't think three is, right? Because, like, they purposely are keeping you in the dark about what Stannis is doing. Like, I remember looking at a number of, like, how many Davos chapters there are, and it's really not that many. It's, like, maybe a dozen across the five books. That, I mean, it's not... Well, five books, yes, but the three books he appears in. I remember being surprised. Particularly Storm of Swords had way less... Stannis content that I remember it being. But I mean, like, the chapters that he appears in, like, a lot happens, but there's a lot less than you would think.
Maybe that's why it just feels like more to me with a lot happening.
Yeah. Like, the Tyrion chapters, like, there's a lot of them, and not all of them have, like, a lot going on. Particularly in, like, Clash of Kings.
Oh, yeah.
But we are not one of those A Song and Ice and Fire analyst podcasts. What kind of podcast are we, Will?
The last I checked, we were a Game of Thrones LCG podcast.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
So I'm Roy, and Will. We are here to talk about what, my friend? What's on our retrospective agenda here?
We're moving into the home stretch now. We are going to be busy with the... Baratheon box, one of the last few official releases, Fury of the Storm.
Mm-hmm. This box was an unhappy playtesting process, let me tell you. Yeah. It was also not fun to test.
Man, the name of this one really bugs me. Does that bug anybody else? The formulation doesn't match the other boxes?
Oh, I think it's because...
They're all things of place, and this is attribute of thing.
What was the bearer box called in first edition?
Oh, that's
a good question. I think it conflicts with the way they named it in first edition. It conflicts with the naming that they used in second edition, if I remember right. That's why they didn't do it.
Let's see here. Man, I have not gone to Card Game DB in several hot minutes. Let's see. It was Kings of the Storm.
Okay.
Which definitely would have matched these other second ed names better though I doubt they would have wanted to follow Kings of the Isles with Kings of the Storm.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's fair. I think it kept the of the, right? Like, is still all of them? Let me take a look real quick. We've got Wolves, Lions, Watchers, House, Dorn, or Sands. Yeah, it's all of the. So it keeps that part of it.
It does. It just changes changes what you're describing, the of and the, but oh well. It's a very, very minor quibble. It just stands out to me when I'm looking at them all in a list and I'm like, one of these things is not like the others.
Absolutely. What's the best big picture thing to say about this box? I think that this box has some really high highs in terms of power level. There's some of the most broken cards that they have ever printed are in this. We'll get to Azor Ahai Reborn in a little bit. And then there's just some real garbage in this box as well. So there's some like high highs, low lows. And I just think this box is like, I really do consider it an actively miserable product. I think that the Greyjoy box starts my feelings about that. And then this, like the Greyjoy box, I mean, it's difficult to disentangle the playtesting process of these last three products, which were actively miserable, and each one got more and more miserable as it went along.
Were they all separated, like separate experiences, or was it all one pool?
If I remember correctly, it went Greyjoy box, Bearer box, King's Landing, Targ box was how it was tested.
Oh,
but
was the Bearer box in Dev Hell for a while?
I could be. It wasn't in Dev Hell, but there's a part of me that like we did them out of the use because the order used to be like cycle, box, cycle, but there was at one point. There was two boxes tested back to back, and I think it was the Greyjoy Bearer box, but that's testing my memory. But that just like so many of the designs here just are like not fun, and they weren't fun in playtesting, and they aren't fun in to play with them. Like I just there's so very few cards in the Bearer box that I can look back on and say, like, I really enjoy playing these. I mean, that's and playing against it. That's like a reoccurring theme, I think, across the final three boxes. Excuse me. But this one, it stands out as very extreme in that. But that could just be because I will admit my biases. I was very tired of playing against the Bearer cohort deck by the end of the game.
Okay.
And the engine card of that exists in this box. So
that might skew your perception then. I mean, I definitely think that, yes, there are some problem cards here. But on the other hand, I do think there are some cards here that kind of expand Baratheon's space in interesting ways. So it had a very kind of narrow slice of the color pie in the past that it felt like they kind of struggled to figure out how to handle. And I feel like there are some cards here that expand that nicely. And on the other hand, there are some cards that like fundamentally don't work right. Like should not exist in the way it came out because of bizarre things it does as written. I'm looking at you, Cascavale.
I mean, Cascavale is one of the weirdest. Oh, that's it. You know what, Will? You just actually proved me a liar. Because I have really enjoyed playing Cascavale against people. That's true. Like, David and Glazer built this Martell Alliance Stag. What was this? Second house, the third house, I can't remember, but it built around Cask of Ale interactions. And oh man, is this an obnoxious card to play against? But I actually don't think the Bearer cards are where to start. I think we should probably choose probably the most flash in the pan like went from zero hero to zero faster than almost any other agenda, mostly on the back of it was really broken in one faction, and once they restricted that faction to an acceptable power level, it didn't work in any other faction, with the prince that was promised. Do you think that's a decent place to start with this?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we frequently start with the agendas, so I think that that's a good direction to go.
Yeah, they are frequently the most powerful cards in any product, right? And most shape deck building over any of them. So what do you think of Prince that was promised?
Gosh, what to say that isn't kind of retreading some of our talk before? Well, you know what? It's a separate episode, so it's probably fine to retread some of that ground. In a very like theoretical sense, I don't have a problem with the idea. It definitely gives me a strong Nedley connection of what's going on here that I can buy into. And it definitely also plays into some of those stated design goals for second edition with really pushing the unique characters and that type of thing. But in actual application, it runs into at least two problems that we've harped on quite a bit in prior episodes. One in that this feels kind of forced in the end, just as far as Danny looking at things and saying, well, we had that intrigue themed agenda and we had that military themed agenda. We got to come up with something for the power challenge. So that aspect feels kind of shoehorned here. And then also this kind of unrestricted search, digging all the way through. And actually in this case, it's even bigger and more so than other cards. We've said that's kind of a problem since we get to go through discard and dead pile. I mean, I understand some of that from a necessity point, if you're going to gear your entire deck around a single unique character, and what's the blowout if like that gets removed somehow, but maybe that just kind of points that some of the tensions in this particular design don't line up well in actual play.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So those are most of my thoughts at the moment.
Yeah, I think I mean, I definitely want to second your, I mean, how just unnecessary at the time, and I think definitely in retrospect, this cycle, using that as the magic design term, which means you have a series of cards based around the same theme that explore different aspects, right, of it. The cycle of agendas around the different challenge types feels so unnecessary and forced at the end of them. Like, yeah. Reigns of Castamere is a very elegant design. I think as much as I didn't appreciate its role in the meta at the time when it was released, I can appreciate going back that it is a very elegant design and that Alvaro deserves a lot of credit for that. So does Nate and Danny. But of course, we've talked over and over again about how busted Sea of Blood was. And then yeah. Prince that was promised with those Greyjoy Prince decks showed the sheer danger of this. The other thing that I think you didn't hit on that I want to talk about is repetitive play patterns. That's kind of been my bugbear over the last several episodes.
Sure.
And this card really does promote repetitive games.
Yeah.
And the fact
even more so than Sea of Blood, really, which is, yeah, swing for military, but like maybe what you commit to that and what your goal is with it and whatever varies a little from board state to board state. The Prince that was promised really zeroes in on, oh no, make a power challenge with the exact same character with the same goal every turn.
Correct. And what I also mean is, so with many agendas and many powerful card types, you can interact with them. So like if you really hate HRD, You can run Frozen Solid, which gets around HRD in second edition. You can play the Greyjoy location control that bounces the location, right? You can like really go out of your way to say, you know what? And there are definitely some Thrones players who feel this way about certain cards and certain playstyles. They're like, you know, I will never lose to a wall deck. Sure, I'll lose to every Lannister and Tyrell mid-range deck in the tournament, but I will never lose to the wall. All right, or I'll never lose to Shadows. And if you want to say that about Prince That Was Promised, it's harder because literally every zone but removed from the game, and there's what? At most two or three effects that can remove a character from the game? I'm trying to think. The Lysa Arryn, I think, all does that, and maybe a couple other ones that like say, I do not have to play against this card anymore. Oh my god.
And Lysa wasn't even out at this correct point. So,
and wait, the question is this agenda worth it in interestingness to overcome that repetitiveness? And it's not, right? There's so much bad design in this. The fact that, like, I do not like the other characters you can't control cannot gain power. Not from, like, that's over unbalanced or anything or a bad drawback per se, but the fact that have you ever played against or watched a game where people forget that? Because I have.
Yes.
Like, and it's just like asking players to really like unintentionally cheat, right? Like a lot of times in card games, like people make a good faith mistake. Like it's easy to forget the splashy trinket drawback text right without even trying to cheat. You know what I mean?
Like, and this is drawback text where forgetting could literally end a game and people might have shuffled up and moved on before realizing they screwed up. Like, correct. It's one thing if you, I don't know, let's say accidentally count a gold somehow from a location when you're playing Knights of Hollow Hill. Yes, that might affect the outcome of the game, but it doesn't usually end the game, like, by virtue of the win condition. And absolutely, forgetting this one could.
This one definitely can. And then it has the stupid thing where it can draw the card. You can still draw the card even though you don't have the character in play by winning the power challenge by 5 or more.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's just like, it's a card that asks so much of the people playing it, both from, like, a repetitive standpoint and, like, knowing the card well and its fiddliness for really, really low fun game. Right? Like, and you see this from the fact that the most successful deck playing this was the Greyjoy Prince decks. And yes, I know there were some minor Prince decks that floated up around with other characters and other factions. Excuse me. But they were never as powerful. So you have this, like, either busted because the Greyjoy card pool is so powerful and the ability to say, I'm always going to have Balon. Excuse me. Or I'm always going to have Euron, and they're always going to kick your ass over and over and over again and be this perfect rush engine. Or I'm not going to be able to do very much. I'm not going to be able to keep up with the other powerful agendas. It's really, really, really just unfun. Like, this agenda, it reads fun, but yeah, ends up playing really unfunly. And that's one of the things I really do not like about Prince.
Yeah, it reads like a big Shaga haymaker card, but it didn't really play out that way.
I mean, we all forget, like, literally the decks that were best about Greyjoy Prince made it so the Greyjoy Prince player couldn't play games. Like, the most consistently powerful deck was Free Folk, right? And the way it beat Prince was that the Greyjoy player just simply couldn't keep cards on the table. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how you beat Prince. Because if you, and every time the Free Folk deck lost was because what they just had one too many saves. And then they could just run away. Right? Yeah. So the way to, when this agenda is good, the best way to interact with it is to make it so your opponent doesn't play games? Like, no.
The very definition of NPE there.
Right? Yeah, I mean, same is true with Sea of Blood, right? They're both terrible designs, but in very different ways. And yeah, I'm greatly frustrated by this card, and yeah.
It's fascinating to me though that both of the military and the power agendas wound up having these ginormous, like, unmitigated searches. And I'm just sitting here trying to think, like, man, what if Intrigue let you search your collection for a plot or something? I don't even know how you would be able to, like, make that comparable, but anyway.
Well, first edition had some of the, like, had search your collection cards, right? Like, wasn't it, didn't have the dragon's eggs that in the final cycle that did that?
Were
those even legal in
competitive
play? I can't remember, but definitely there were those, like, eggs that's like, search your collection or for a Drogon card, right? Or a whatever card.
Yeah, I actually do not remember that now.
I mean, they were terrible. I think they were priced in a way so that no one would ever really ask the question, are they legal in competitive play? The classic FFG, like, way of dealing with these things, but...
Sneaky. You get to say you printed it, but without any of the downside.
That's fair.
Let's see here. Oh, nope, wrong. Well, that should still work. Search by name for egg. Black dragon egg. No, it's search your deck.
Search your deck.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Do we want to talk about the plots, or do you want to move to the Barra cards in general?
No, I think we should continue on with the plots here and hit the neutral stuff. Really, I don't think there's a ton in the plot realm to hit on, but there's at least a gem or two and a couple that, like, people tried, even if they didn't get there, which maybe is actually where I would like to start, just because we spent this time talking about Sea of Blood, and I'm sitting here looking at rationing, which is one of the most obvious kind of silver bullet cards we've gotten in reference to one specific other card, basically.
I mean Rashi was a surprisingly good card, right? Like, I saw it a lot. It was good in Kohor decks in particular, right? Because Kohor can still do its thing.
Yeah, since it's a reaction to claim.
Yeah, since it's a reaction to claim, not a reaction to actually winning the challenge. I think it's one of those, it's like, it's difficult to word this card in a way that's, like, really clear, right? Like, a new player or an inexperienced player might read this and be like, okay, no effects
right
that deal with winning or losing a challenge can be initiated, but it's only things that are part of the duck step, right? Let me just double check the rulings here. Force reactions still trigger, still gain power, Lord of the Crossing. Cool. Yep, I was right. Cool.
Yeah.
And it saw some play at the high point of Sea of Blood. You saw some even Valerian Steel decks that were running it. Some of those winter decks that were very, like, floating around, like the Stark winter builds that were kind of floating around were definitely playing it. Like, and it's aggressive. Like, one of the things is also really, it's aggressive. It's like screaming at you to play this, right?
It's five. It's five, really where winter five plots needed to be for a while.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think by the time the last, I think maybe it might have been by this time. I don't know. I can't remember if there are any impactful winter plots in the Targaryen box, but I think there was a playable winter package by the time Ration came out. You know, where you can play that card that raises the stats on all your winter plots and kind of have a point where there's enough overstatted winter plots that if you really do take into consideration, the opportunity cost is worth it. Like, and you definitely saw that in some low to the ground Stark decks. That's sort of what stands out to me, is there was definitely some low to the ground Stark decks. But rationing, I think rationing ended up being a pretty healthy escape valve because it still lets you play some good old fashioned thrones. Like, it doesn't stop the game moving forward, right? The way in which, like, what's the anti-rush plot. Unexpected delay? No. The one that every time you initiate a challenge, you have to give up a power? What is that called? It's escaping. What is this?
Good gravy. How to phrase the search in order to find that? Because, man, I'm having trouble with that.
Yeah, I'm forgetting it. But, like, that is in some ways a similar card to this, right? It's trying to, like, slow down the game, prevent some big splashy effects. You know.
Uneasy truce.
Uneasy truce. There we go. Unlike Uneasy Truce, it doesn't, like, discourage you from doing challenges, right? Like, you still get unopposed. You still get the claim effect, right? You just don't get your Sea of Blood trigger. You don't get your Prince trigger. You don't get your, events that trigger off winning. But you still, the game moves forward, right? Which, yeah. I think is a healthy place for these kind of plots to be.
Yeah, no, I think... I inadvertently gave the impression that I was down on this plot in some form. And no, I honestly think it's like a perfectly healthy effect to have floating around in the game. It's just that the timing of its release made it feel like such a targeted silver bullet aimed at Sea of Blood as compared to some of the other effects we've gotten that have felt much more general.
That's fair. So I think the most impactful plot that was printed in this box is Parlay, right? At Storm's End, the Loyal Bearer plot. I think this was consistently in everything but Bearer Cohort, and there were some Bearer Cohort decks that still ran it, at least for a while. I could be wrong. I could be misremembering that, but I feel like sometimes I played against this when I was playing against Bearer Cohort. But it was definitely in the Bear Conclave lists, the Bear Shadows lists. I mean, just the ability to turn off a challenge type.
This is also cool. In every Bear Melee list, too.
Yep.
Turning off a whole challenge type for the entire board. Whew. That is spicy. I mean,
naming power in Melee has got to slow the game to a crawl. I mean, not that Melee is already a fast. You know, it's a degenerate, but not necessarily fast.
Agreed. Game
or format, but definitely I think this was really impactful. What is the best way to think about this? Part of me loves this card. Like, I appreciate, like, it reminds me of the Corset card,
Come
over Westeros
challenge.
Yeah, reduces almost, the enable one, reduce your opponent's claim by one.
Yeah,
Come over Westeros. Like, I feel like that's a healthier design than this is, right? Because your opponent still gets, can still trigger their put, can still trigger their, you know, whatever. But they operate similar spaces. And, you know, like, I like this plot. I wish this plot couldn't turn off the power challenge. Because it can scroll, it can turn games to a crawl. I like this card early, being able to, like, you have a shitty setup and you say military on the first turn. Awesome. Like, I really like that.
Right.
You know, you have one really powerful card you don't want to lose to Intrigue Claim. Name Intrigue. Cool. I don't like my opponent's at 14 power and I just name power. And, you know, okay, so I'm taking a turn off. Right? Like, that I think is a little too powerful, simply because it is better for games to end than to just go on forever. And definitely Parlay can sometimes contribute to games not ending.
Yeah. If it had that restriction, that also I probably would have lined up better with kind of established Baratheon stuff. I mean, yes, they were kind of established as the kings of power challenges, a general theme, but mostly the way that kind of was represented in the game was, hey, we're going to do this cool thing unless you can beat me in the power challenge, right? It creates this incentive to make big power challenges and try to, like, outswing Baratheon on it to turn off their, you know, Storm's End or whatever. Not Storm's End.
Red Keep.
What's the draw location from the Corset?
Red Keep, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, a handful of other effects, but it would have lined up nicely with that concept rather than potentially just turning it off. So they get to just keep all of that stuff.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Very impactful plot, though. Maybe, what, the second or third best of these faction-specific plots? And
I mean, it had to kind of try to outweigh the first Baratheon plot. The
actively unplayable one, which we talked about. You could go back to our first
one. I know we did. Yeah, the King's Peace. Oof.
Yeah, ugh. Oof. I think it's worth briefly talking about Outwit, which was one of the most tested cards in playtesting for this box. It went through so many iterations. A lot of people had, and this is very belittling, and I apologize, but I have no other way of saying it. A lot of people, off the top of my head, like had PTSD from Outwit in first edition. A lot of the playtesters, they just really had issues with it that couldn't be overcome. And so there was a lot of back and forth where it was very powerful, and then it was brought to basic uselessness, and then made really powerful, and then brought to what they thought was a balanced state. And I think it ended up being mostly useless.
Yeah.
I think my favorite deck at the end of second edition was Baromaesters.
Interesting.
Oh yeah, I loved that deck. I should have played it at Worlds. I really regret chickening out and playing Night's Watch Valyrian Steel, because I would have lost and least enjoyed my games. Rather than losing and not enjoying the games, like I did playing Valyrian Steel at Worlds. And that deck had a ton of Maesters. It like wanted Outwit really badly, but it couldn't afford to have Outwit. And that says a lot about a deck that was really, it was a very powerful Baro deck, and it was a very powerful Maesters deck, and it was legitimately built around Maesters and Maester synergies. It really loved Maester Morrowind, who we'll talk about next time, and Maester the 4/3 Tyrell one, Maester Gorman? Is that what he was named?
Yeah, that sounds right, Gorman.
The one that lives literally
top of deck.
Top of deck, non-Tyrell card, you can play it.
Yeah.
Like really based around the synergies with those cards and the Conclave agenda. So a legit Conclave deck. And it just couldn't afford to have Outwit, because this plot, when you miss,
you are not left with much.
Yes. 3-0-1-5. Oof. I mean, I lost this card several times in first edition, especially melee. It was a very powerful melee.
I mean, when it was substantially better, would it have 6 initiative back then?
Something like that.
Yeah. And of course, 3 income still, which probably equates to more like 5 in second ed, and, you know, didn't have the
need. Closer to 4, I think. 3 was closer to 4, I think, in.
Okay, I'm willing to take that. It's more than just a flat.
Oh yeah, like 3 is pretty brutal in second edition, but it was not brutal at all. It was sort of like, okay,
yeah,
like I don't want to open a 3 gold plot in first edition that has 3 gold, but I can. I can still play cards.
Didn't want to, but if you felt very strongly about a plot they needed on their side, You definitely did it sometimes.
You definitely did. Yeah, I don't know, even know if I wish this card was better designed. Have we talked a lot about plot cancel? Have we talked through it?
You know, I'm not really sure we have.
Because I think we missed it. We missed our opportunity to talk about the Martell card that cancels plots.
I think you're right.
I'm of so many minds about plot cancel. Like, there's a part of me that thinks that some plot cancel is healthy, because there are some very swingy plots, Valar Morghulis being the biggest example, that it's kind of good to, like, have an escape valve where your opponent has to worry at least a little bit. If it's like, okay, well, what happens here if my opponent has some plot cancel?
Right.
Like, do I have a backup plan? Or are you just consistently able to put your opponent in, you know, situations where, you know, there's no real choice, right? I like that tension. But of course, if that tension ever gets out of control, it's easy to break, right? Like, when Outwit was playable in first edition, it was almost always doing broken things, right? It was protecting an unfair start, or protecting, you know, some busted combo.
Solidifying a game and, like, locking your opponent out of trying to get back in the game.
And in the case of Melee, it could sometimes be multiple opponents, right? Like,
yeah,
definitely there were some Baron Maester decks in Melee that could get so much power on the first turn that it took two players Valoring, right, in order to get through. And then there was always that game where one time Steve Simone f***ed me in a Worlds Melee game where, like, we're going back and forth, and we, like, knew our opponent was going to flip out Wit. And I was like, Steve, we both Valor here, and it's highly likely that, like, you win, I come in second. But Steve calculated that it was more likely if I Valored and he didn't, that he would come in second. And so he was like, you know, he agreed to double Valor and he didn't. Oh. And because he would rather have coming, like, 90% come in second rather than 85% come in first, right? Those DC guys in there, you know, their odds. And that was a brutal thing. It's stuff like that, right? Like, that Outwit does that effects like it that I don't like. And that is, of course, a tension and cancel in all games, but plots feel very sacred as well in Thrones, because it is, like, one of the most unique mechanics. So I, as much as I appreciate the tension, I feel like it's worth just not printing plot cancel.
I mean, they do, but it's such an iconic mechanic of the game, and that tension of what plot do I play and when do I play it, and that what's my opponent going to reveal, and that kind of cat and mouse apprehension back and forth is something that I know really drew a lot of players and really excited, like, reviewers and stuff when the game originally launched way back when.
But also when second edition launched as well, right? Like,
sure.
It's one of the biggest draws to this game.
Yes, yes, definitely. And so I do like how plot-based plot cancel really leans into that and really emphasizes that as a key tension point of the game. I'm definitely not in favor of draw deck based event cancel plot cancel. I think that is pretty much always going to be a bad move, and just really amp up that all of the possible downsides that you just brought up, but with none of the upside of kind of emphasizing a core attractive mechanic of the game. But I do agree that it is very hard to hit a good middle ground where cancels aren't a blowout one way or the other. Either you've revealed something really bad and whiffed, or you hit and totally blow your opponent out because of that hit. So I like the idea, just acknowledge that it is very tough.
Yeah, and I agree with you. For my personal logic, and I definitely think people can fairly draw the line in different places, I guess this is definitely a design space that I would be hyper conservative with, rather than what the kind of direction Outwit points towards. You know, I think Outwit the way they printed Elwit doesn't work. It's like too bad for what the effect wants to do. And so, like, for Outwit to work as a card, it has to be stronger, and that pushes it well past my line, right?
Okay.
If that makes sense, right? Because I would, like, I prefer... I
would so
prefer...
you would just, like, start from scratch to come up with something new.
Absolutely. Like, something... I think there was an effect like this, maybe in first edition, and it might even have been reprinted in the bin pack, where you force your opponent to reveal a different plot.
Oh yeah, yeah, the Gathering Storm. Yeah,
that's a kind of plot cancel that I'm much more about, because okay, yeah, I don't get the Valar Morghulis issue, but like, what was the other plot that besides Valar Morghulis that I would have flipped, right?
So what multiples was my... do weird things.
Yeah, oh, I definitely agree. I definitely can break melee, and definitely can even break two player games. But I think that, like, that's the style of plot cancel that I would be much more about, right? Where, yeah, you don't get to Valor me, or you don't get your giant, you don't get your trade routes this turn, right? What's right. your backup plan? Give, like, show me your backup plan. Let's play that game. Versus you tried to Valor me, cancel. You, yeah. I'm way ahead of you. You need that trade routes to pay, you know, three big characters to stay in the game. You don't get that, right? That's kind of more where let's keep playing this game. Let's keep doing interesting things for each other rather than saying, fuck you, which is what Outwit does. When you land, it's the player who's played Outwit has said, fuck you to their opponent. And when you miss, the player who benefited from that gets to say, fuck you to the Outwit player. Like, and I would prefer less fuck you situations. you know, because like Thrones maybe thematically is all about fuck you, but, you know, as a game that you got to play a lot, and you got to play with friends, I would much rather there be just a game continues rather than ending on the spot.
Actually, I have to say, you really kind of brought me around on that just now. I was sitting here thinking about, oh, doing some kind of condition where if you didn't cancel, you, I don't know, got a couple gold or something, so that you at least got kind of a middling blank plot instead of an all downside. But I think you convinced me that more of a just a temporary hey, you have to choose something else is probably a better direction to go.
Oh, bear cards? Or do you want to talk more about some of these plats that didn't quite land?
I mean,
siege. Well, we didn't talk about siege
preps
that landed.
That's probably the only other one that's really worth it, right?
Yeah, limit once per phase is so interesting. Are there effects that let you copy that? I guess theoretically, because it's an action, you could trigger it multiple times.
I guess
the problem with that is it just seems weird. It.
Yeah.
Which it
just seems weird. Sort of like, I just wonder, well, I guess maybe just a flavor decision to not make it a reaction to like somebody winning or losing dominance, like after dominance is determined or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. It could be a bunch of different things, I suppose, but I was just trying to think about other ways that would have been worded that didn't need the limit once per phase.
What I don't like about this card, as from a design level, is that you can miss it. And like sometimes if you're particularly because it's in a phase that frequently like mechanically you move through relatively quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, take the power. And then if you go, I'm going to stand my guys. And then you go, oh, wait, you know, in your brain, you've, you know, everybody's moving quickly to keep the game going. And this is a problem with dominance effects and quite kind of also end of challenge phase effects that I don't really like, you know, in hyper competitive situations. I understand that people need to remember their triggers. But it is easy as you're moving through these wrap up steps to move quickly because you want to get to the interesting parts of the game right. That aren't just like the administrative parts of the game, which kind of the last three phases of Thrones are.
I mean,
And if you've ever been the person who has on Iron Throne accidentally clicked through their siege prep.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah.
Like, I wish it was like forced reaction at the end of, you know, you may, when Jaman's face begins, you may draw until your hand sizes.
Yeah.
So that means if you forget, go back, do it. You get to choose.
Right.
So if you don't want to draw those cards, because it might make, you don't have to, but it there kind of like makes it so that there's like, boom. And I know there's a whole school of people who are like, no, remember your triggers. What makes good Thrones players are the ones who remember their triggers. I think you should need to cut down on feel bad moments, and definitely seed prep. I've seen feel bad moments.
No, I think that type of phrasing definitely would have been much more in line with kind of standard Thrones phrasing as well. And eliminated the limit once per phase and so on. Like, I think I would have liked that. Part of what seems weird to me with it here is, like you said, dominance is in a lot of ways a fairly forgotten phase of the game that people tend to rush through. However, there is one faction that actually cares about it. Yet, like, mystifyingly, there's virtually nothing in this box that cares about dominance. Like, if this box had come with a flood of other dominance effects to make people pay attention to that phase, give them things to do, things to be thinking about triggering rather than just this one effect. I mean, and frankly, that's probably what I would have done with all of the off factions for this box, is giving them something to do in the dominance phase. But anyway, it didn't happen.
Well,
that would have been one other way to tackle that issue, is to like expand the breadth of times that people would care about dominance. So,
yeah, no, definitely. I agree in some sense, but I can say that it was a conscious design decision. Like, it wasn't just accident, right? Like, in the the like designer notes that we got when we were playtesting this, was like, specifically Barra was trying to explore space beyond dominance, right? Because the most successful Barra decks up to this point were dominance based, right? So it's like, let's support different themes, which I think is completely fair. There's actually one dominance card, right? Isn't like Storm's? No, maybe I'm wrong. I thought there was at least one.
There might be one that.
Oh, there's the Rulor card that swaps between players. You get a power and give it to your opponent. Accolade of Flame.
Which was he?
Might not actually be in the box.
Nope. Must not be.
It must not be in the box. It must be in one of the sets. So there may not be any dominance cards.
Which I can understand wanting to expand Baratheon and not do that again here. That's honestly why I said I probably would have done that with all of the off houses in this box.
But I'm actually from a different school of thought, and this is something I've definitely thought about more over time with Thrones, is I actually want fewer things in the cleanup steps. Right? Like, because like, there's like a lot of weird, like, if Thrones had a phase called like upkeep or whatever, where like standing, taxation, dominance were all dealt with together.
You just combined it. Yeah.
Combined them all into one. I'd be much cooler with there being a bunch of shit going on. But the fact that there's three separate ones and need to remember each one of them, and there's specific effects that only trigger in each one, and frequently an effect in a previous phase will hold until a specific phase, or you need to go to standing to make sure that something doesn't happen in different phases. It's a lot of upkeep. It's a lot of remembering. And the focus of this game, to me, is on the marshalling and the challenges phase. And the more you add on to these like miscellaneous phases that like most players want to get to the, there's what, seven phases in Thrones? Plot.
Yeah.
Right. They want to get to the kind of four exciting ones, which is plots,
drawing your cards, marshaling cards, and fighting, right? Like, that's like, what's fun. And most people are like, you know, oh, yeah, I'm going to, like, they do dominance and untapping and, you know, discarding cards all at the same time, right? Like, even at competitive tournaments, people do that to shortcut it, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's, you only ever really see the hardcore Magic, people who come from hardcore Magic, or the Sharks be like, clearly move to dominance, clearly move to standing, clearly move to taxation. That's a cleaner way to play, and I'm not begrudging people who do that, but just the natural player experience is to move through those phases quickly. So making those phases matter as little as possible would be something I would want, because I think it makes the game friendlier and it makes tournaments like less miserable. Like I really don't like losing games because of phase screw-ups. I don't like watching people lose games because of that. And I don't like giving people the opportunity to shark each other where, you know, if I go and take three power, if I'm playing a wall deck and I go and take three power from my box and I go, I win dominance, two power from the wall. And my opponent goes, when you said I win dominance, that means you moved in the dominance phase. You don't get your wall trigger. I hate that. And I want as few opportunities for players to do that as possible, because I think that that way of approaching games is, well, competitively, I don't even want to say healthy, can promote competitive integrity. I think it's something that your game system should make it so you don't need to act that way. And you don't want to have systems in place that encourage your players to act that way. And a lot of Thrones really does. So,
I mean, I don't know. I'm back and forth there. Like, yes, some people could be jerks with how they present that, but also, like, there has to be a timing structure.
Agreed.
That both players agree on that follows a like standardized formula. So then, because if you don't have that, when do you say, like, oh shoot, I forgot to draw my cards, and how do you fix that? And like, it gets very nebulous, and now it's suddenly, rather than being rules that we are relying on, it's now you're putting me as a player on the spot as far as like my good nature in order to have something competitive and playable, or you just can't have something competitive, like a co-op game or something, which, don't get me wrong, I love those. They're great, but that's just a different type of game that is inherently okay with kind of a fuzzy-wuzzy nature of timing, because it doesn't matter. The aspect of fairness does not exist the same way.
I agree with you, Will. I think
it's real rich coming from a guy whose only regional win is by literally doing that.
Kyle, did somebody message you and tell you to join just for that moment? Because I was thinking about you when Roy brought this up. And I was like, oh, too bad Kyle's not here.
Well, I have to say, Will, I agree with a lot of what you're saying there. I think what Thrones does is its structure encourages a lot of that in unhealthy ways, right? Like, and you see this with other competitive card games, is like there's an increasing like push to try to make it so that you don't end up in situations where you have to do that a lot, right? You always are going to have to do that in competitive games, right? And Thrones has so many phases and so many steps that it's easy for players to make good faith mistakes just trying to play the game smoothly and quickly, particularly because Thrones is also a best of one 55-minute game, right? Where time is like up is very much a premium in Thrones. And there's just like lots of places for people to fuck up in good faith. And you ran big events. Kyle, you also ran big events. Did FFG ever provide guidance for how you resolve an issue? Like, for example, someone misses their draw step. Like,
Yes, always. I'm very confused. Did you not get the pamphlet at your event?
I did not. Oh, no.
Whoops, missed out.
Well, I mean, they did love you Midwesterners. They didn't even respond to my email when I asked for, when everyone applied to get nationals. So they just gave it to Will without, you know, even like sending me a rejection email. So they were like meaner than the American Historical Association, meaner than that job that emailed me a year later after I applied.
A year later?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's even meaner than the job that flew me out there and were like, we'll get back to you in a week, and never got back to me and relisted the job 2 weeks later. Like, they at least, like, did things, like, interacted with me. FFG, I sent this long email, worked with our local stores, signed it by a bunch of East Coast players. I was like, they'll at least tell us, you know, fuck off. Nope. Just Will messages me. He's like, great news. We got nationals. And I was like, okay, can we at least get a reject, like a 3-sentence rejection email?
Oh, like,
I wanted to be told I was a qualified candidate, Will. I wanted to be told I was a qualified candidate, but there are just better people like you out there in the world that I could sleep at night. But now I don't know if I'm qualified. I don't know if I'm qualified.
I feel like
I think you're qualified, Roy.
We definitely just went through Roy's like therapy session from last week, just replaced like with Will's name.
Are we? Is this the thing now, Will? Are we going to have random old guest hosts come join in the middle of episodes? I love it.
Yeah, you know, I kind of hope we do. I'm enjoying it.
I'm enjoying it, too.
It's okay. Take it or leave it.
I mean, you'll probably leave it in a few moments, I'm sure.
Well, Kyle, since you're here, let me ask you. What stands out to you? What do you remember of the second edition Baratheon box? Is there any cards that stand out to you? Let's switch out the card.
Putting Kyle on that spot.
I'm a level. That was a that was the filthy casual phase of my card playing experience. I remember these yellow cards are bad. Moving on with my life. Is that not what you guys took away from it? Did you guys think, wow, what a treasure trove of creativity?
Just treasure trove of something. I wouldn't describe it as creativity.
There's a couple cards I like, for sure. We just haven't really gotten to that yet.
No, we were about to get... We actually are, what, 45 minutes in, and we haven't really gotten to the bear cards.
I was like, classic. Are you cooking? Doesn't sound like it.
We tend to spend a lot of time on the agendas.
That's fair. They're the most interesting thing in the box, so I get it.
Definitely. The agendas and the plots, we lead with them, and that's where the most conversation ends up happening. So
that's fair. Love it. All right, well, I'm going to go do dishes again. not on the podcast, because I care.
Thank you.
We love you, Kyle.
You too. There you go, listeners. I'm actually going to leave that in because I think it's fun. So
it was fun.
You're welcome.
I particularly appreciated Kyle not knowing any of these cards. That was that was the best part. That's what's worth keeping.
Man, I was more just thinking the timing. That was just absolutely stellar when we're talking about being sticklers for timing of triggers and such, and like slowly walking through phases properly, because Kyle is not wrong in that I won a regional over him due to being a stickler.
Oh, you beat Kyle. Oh, wow.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's a bitter fruit you tasted there.
Yeah, that's why the timing of him joining right then was so apt.
I definitely think it's worth it. So why do you, Will, you're a bit, I think, more positive on these yellow cards. Like Kyle thought that they're just garbage. I think a lot of them are just bad designs. So there's like maybe one card in here that I have any positive feelings towards. So what do you think?
Gosh, well, particularly some of the ones that I have positive feelings about, I guess maybe it's worth tackling from a kind of theme perspective. because there's a few different themes that we get addressed here. One of which is kind of, I want to say tribal. They're not really tribal style effects, but it is the R'hllor tribe in general here. I do like most of the R'hllor cards in this box. Stuff like Red Priest and even Acolyte of the Flame do interesting things that, like I was saying at the beginning of this review episode or retrospective episode, that kind of expand the slice of color pie that Baratheon has gotten. And they don't feel off color or anything, but it's just kind of like, oh yeah, like that fits. That's kind of interesting. It fits specifically with the flavor of that kind of sub faction tribe, and does it in interesting ways. I mean, even if Red Priest is effectively just a crib off of a Magic card, there's only so many effects to go around in card games, I suppose. So those are a couple of my standouts. There's a few others I would probably list that I really like that we can head toward, but I'll pause there for a moment.
There are fewer cards that I wanted to love more than Red Priest.
You didn't in the end.
Love Brain Maggot effects or Kite Sail Freebooter effects, which are magic cards that do the same thing as this. Although this can remove economy cards, but that's not like a huge thing in Thrones. Like, the problem with like a lot of these cards, though, is it's very similar to Treachery, which is a card that I theoretically should really like, but I hate, because it was most commonly used as a tempo lock card, where I played my busted Robert and Azor Ahai, you've got the put to the sword, the bounce, the powerful character. Oh, I play my red priest. I get your answer. Boom, I win.
I mean, aren't those types of effects doing at least that bad of a thing in Magic?
Well,
it's either protect my beat stick or like remove your one combo piece so your deck doesn't work anymore. I guess occasionally it's like eat a counterspell or something, but like,
I think that in Magic, it's easier to remove them, right? And the ways in which Magic scales linearly. So like I play my Brain Maggot on two. The most I can have done that turn is play a two drop, right? Or a three drop.
Semi-linearly, since you're not always drawing third, fourth, fifth right, mana succession, but yeah.
Right, right. It's not turn one, you play this, you take my seven drop. I could have played my seven drop, right?
Right.
Right, the way in which Thrones works. And I think that this effect doesn't translate well to Thrones because of that. And also because removal is frequently priced as plots or as in challenge phase interaction, right? So, like, I could remove it with a Put to the Sword, or I could remove it with a Incinerate. Oh my god, what is the thing? Oh my god, this shows you how much out of the Dracarys. There we go. Wow. Not remembering a Corset card that is one of the most played cards in second edition. Wow, Rogers.
I would have helped if I'd known which one you were going for, but I was like, it could be any removal card. I don't know which one.
Dracarys, right? Like, they're all challenge-based interaction, right? And so if this Red Priest doesn't interact in challenges, it's extremely difficult to remove, and it requires me to use one of my removal plots.
Sort of. I think you're sidestepping an aspect of the game where in Magic, you must have that targeted removal. Well, a removal card. I suppose it doesn't have to be targeted. It could be a Wrath effect or a Pyroclasm or whatever. But if you do not have that card and they elect to not put that creature into combat, it's not going to die. In Thrones, the challenge system, particularly Military Claim, inherently means that character is at risk of dying, whether it is in challenges or not.
That is completely fair. But I think frequently it feels like the Red Priests were not dying at a rate in which I think makes this card fun to play against. Does that make sense? And it could easily be my own feelings about the role that this card played in the Barak cohort deck, which, I mean, again, a lot of my feelings about the cards in this box are overlaid by what that deck did.
Yeah. I think it's personal perception on these.
I mean, that's completely fair. Like, because, like, in testing and in what I wanted Red Priest to be is I wanted it to be a fair, like a mid-ranger control card, right? Where, you know, you do play on turn one, take someone's Tywin, but the game continues from there. While frequently it felt like Red Priest was played as I take your maybe one of two or only way of interacting with the Barak cohort player, and then you can't interact anymore with the Barak cohort player, and they win. And that was sort of where my feelings about Red Priest get overlaid. Because there's like, this was the card I was most excited about. And I played it and I was like, oh, this card is fun, cool. And then I played against Barak cohort and I was like, I want to die. Like, I hate this. I hate everything about it. Yeah. And again, that might have to do with the card that is maybe worth, because I keep bringing it up, discussing next, Azor Ahai Reborn. Sure. Like,
let's do it.
This is a card that I think would be obnoxious in a world without cohort, but is so obnoxious in a world without with cohort that I think that this was one of the biggest mistakes that they ever made. In printing.
Really?
Yes. Like
one of the biggest. Interesting.
The fact that you can cause a single character to participate in all three challenges in which you are attacking, particularly with the amount of power acceleration that Baratheon has, both in the form of Renown, but also the six cost Robert. But it, I mean, this card isn't fun with either Robert, right? I played against Barak cohort decks that are running, you know, some variants that are running the Intimidate Bob from the core set, and the Robert that's from the last set, I believe we talked about, right? That was in King's Landing. I mean, it's also very obnoxious with Stannis as a backup. And the fact that if you give, there's just like a lot of ways to abuse this card that makes it just, again, really, really unfun to play against. And the fact that this card synergizes so well with the cohort agenda, and that frequently a single successful challenge can cause this card to spiral out of control when played with cohort, really, really, really is just unfun. Like, I don't think that there's, this card was envisioned as an expensive, fun build around card.
Right. It screams Shaga looking at it to me.
It screams Shaga, and it was tested as a Shaga card. And I will 100% that playtesters completely failed with this card. Like, completely. This card is a failure at every single point of which this box was designed. This card is a failure. It was a failure of the designers who dreamed it up and didn't think about it. It was a failure of the playtesters. It was a failure of the copy editors. Everyone involved with this card should have flagged it as highly problematic. Besides the fact that also, because what's combined though, even without cohort, I think the decision to push R'hllor as hard as they do in this set also is a problem. And I just think that this is, like, honestly one of the biggest should not have been printed cards in second edition, up there with Sea of Blood.
and Valyrian Steel in many ways as well. I think Valyrian Steel is arguably a bit better than these other two. But if we're being like really honest to like absolutely negative effects that it had on the game, these three cards, what's still Kingdom of Shadows on there as well? Kingdom of Shadows, Azor Ahai Reborn, Sea of Blood, Valyrian Steel, all just utterly shaped for the last 12 to 18 months of the game, like what the limits of what you could do were. And it's not a like coincidence that the top four decks at the Final Worlds were those four agendas.
Yeah.
And, well, this isn't an agenda, but the fact that it's powerful enough to basically fuel a deck with the cohort agenda, I think this just is such a huge, huge mistake. And, you know, this card should be just completely unprinted. If I could just go into the file, you know, use my endgame time travel machine and create a parallel universe where it would be like, delete this card from Danny's file, I would do it.
Interesting. Would it, I think I know the answer to this, but would it have been a reasonable Shaga Bomb play card if this was bumped to a four cost attachment or something? Or
I mean, four's pretty high, maybe.
Is it really just that your inherent issue is Kohor giving such easy access to it?
Well, you wouldn't have easy access to it at four. I think the fact that it's not free with the Solace here at four maybe balances it, but like, is it worth, like, is the same, like, and this is like fundamentally, this is something I've really come around to about card games, but in particular, like, I've been, because of this podcast, and also talking with some friends who are considering getting back into second edition, talking about and thinking about Thrones, like, Thrones has a massive repetition problem. And so the question is like, is it worth, is the Shaga capability of this card, like, worth having the same character in three attacking challenges every turn? Like, is it worth, like, is what this card does, like, worth it? Like, is it ever doing something that like you're going to scream, like, oh man, this is really fun? Because, like, you're only ever going to want to attach this to cards that either kneel your opponent's cards, gain you a lot of power, or do something really over the top. But it's not that you get to do it once. Or that it could be canceled, like Seal of the Hand, right? A treachery cancels your opponent's healing. It cancels your opponent's Queen's Guard, right? Like, this is uncancelable unless you blank the attachment or pop the attachment off the character. And frequently, like, there's not a huge amount of challenge phase interaction for that, right? I mean, think, is it worth it? Like, is this card ever worth what it does? Like, is the fun to broken category ever really there?
That is a good, good question. And gosh, now that you have me thinking about it and going down this road, I'm thinking back to the core set days when we spent a lot of time talking about action advantage, probably even up through the first cycle, and how the particular discussion that jumps out at me is our kind of rating of some of the 6 and 7 costers and the clear standouts turning out to be those that generated action advantage for you in a pretty big way. And I guess now that you have me thinking about Azor Ahai Reborn more, it does provide an awful, awful lot of action advantage, and almost certainly on one of those 6 and 7 cost characters. So it does that make it a problem in light of what we were talking about at that time? I'm torn. I mean, it's a separate card. It should require more presence on the board as well in order to maximize that, and a specific trait as well. It feels like there should be enough restrictions on it, but maybe it just wasn't.
I think also the sword, like, it makes some innocent card. Like, in theory, it does what you want for a build around payoff, right? Because it makes cards like the sword from the second cycle that gives characters R'hllor and adds a strength for each R'hllor character I believe you control. Maybe each other R'hllor character you control. Like, theoretically, it makes that card better, right? But that also creates additional redundancy for the R'hllor trait. So, like, you could theoretically balance. Say you're like, this is my R'hllor top end. Like, I want this and Stannis, you know, the big seven cost Stannis to be, or I guess the cycle Stannis is also seven cost, but this big but king,
the Stannis, one from the box here,
the box Stannis, yeah. Right? Box Stannis is your big payoff for playing R'hllor. You're playing all these like mediocre cards, like what's one in this set? Acolyte of Flame, right? Or there's
I like card. Acolyte of Flame.
I know, but like no one's gonna like scream all they want in their decks are Acolyte of Flame.
Sure.
Right, or the one that stands at the beginning of Dominance that like was okay at the core set but was quickly power creeped out. Fiery Followers, right? These like medium cards. You're playing a bunch of just spice, like unspicy medium cards, but you've got this two powerful effects in your deck. Stannis and Azor Ahai that you could slap on a Robert or whatever. Cool. But the sword gives you additional flexibility. It could go on any character. And also makes it easier for you to push through challenges. And means that, of course, that you get an additional flexible R'hllor that goes on any character that can take attachments. And then, of course, what's frustrating about Azor Ahai is it is like R'hllor was originally designed, and each R'hllor card you print makes Core Mel better. And Core Mel is designed as a control and tempo card. And then when you add this rush element to it, you start getting into the point where like you are. Your deck is interacting on like the tempo and speed interaction access, which is really hard frequently for other decks to keep up with. You see this with Greyjoy, right? Which Greyjoy, when it got the Euron with Intimidate, and it got the ability to stand himself all Victarion, right? Like it was able to access on both tempo and speed. And that is very difficult for, and the Stark Crossing deck at its peak, right? It had the ability to tempo you out, but also had speed. Combining these two axes of interaction in Thrones is really hard for decks to deal with. And combine that with the ability to tutor up these effects, particularly turning like a hunting accident into a sword, is very frustrating and just like really unhealthy play patterns.
Well, if I might kind of transition slightly,
we've talked a lot about this
because you mentioned another card just now that I actually really liked and thought it was a really cool way to kind of add to a Baratheon theme while still kind of pushing some new space, and that is Hunting Accident. So I'm curious whether you are okay with it, or as a piece of that kind of whole you were talking about, if you're down on Hunting Accident. I think it's cool. It's kind of a different type of effect here in the Cannot Stand realm, which either requires more of your own stuff to do something with it, or requires your opponent to have utilized the character already somehow. Plus, it brings back ambush in a relevant way. I think it has a lot of cool stuff.
Absolutely. I have complex feelings about Hunting Accident, and Hunting Accident is a card that I can think about outside of the context of Bear Cohort, because I've seen it and played it in decks that don't aren't Barakohor. So it's super Kraven, right? Is what this card is.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
Like, so it's two more gold. And it says that as soon as you use this character, you can't use it for the rest of the game. Unless you have attached for control of the form of Maester, whatever it's Maester Cressen or...
Cressen.
And some, I think that's the best condition hate or something like confiscation. I think, and this is going to be more, this is going to be somebody who plays the wall a lot and like knows Kraven well. I think that this is fundamentally an unhealthier card than Kraven because it, you know, people complain a lot about how Kraven turns their, or Milk, turns their card into a blank piece of cardboard, mm-hmm. right? But Kraven, you can still defend, right? Like, it's easy to forget that because frequently the Night's Watch decks that play Kraven aren't attacking you.
Yeah.
But that does create, like, space, right? Like, okay, you put on my Tywin, you put on my Jaime, whatever. And, all right, so they're not doing anything. But that also means, but Tywin is a beast on defense. Or Robert, sure. Seven, is a beast on defense. So that means that the Night's Watch player isn't attacking me. So that means their way to win the wall is only the wall, which means that, you know, that gives me time to draw out of my situation. Because I have this character that can still defend. And Milk says, okay, my Tywin lost his awesome text box, his badass text box. Or this Robert, the seven cost Robert here, lost his amazing text box. A wonderful text box, as our former president would say. Beautiful text box. The best text box. And the best text box. he loses that, but, you know, he still has two icons and five strength. So if you need him to defend or you need him to attack, he can still do that. It's like not a waste of a piece of cardboard. It can still perform game actions. Haunting Accident means that your character can't perform any actions anymore. Or very few unless they have passive abilities. And there are some decent passive abilities might. Out there. They might. And frequently, like, I mean, that's like a small drawback to Haunting Accident. But I think overwhelmingly the best cards, like, the single best card that this doesn't do anything against is Mace. Like, I'm trying to think of, like, there are many more Tywins than there are Maces, right? Like, Robert is a Mace.
Though, I mean, you're still getting something out of the Tywin. You're not getting his full effect, but you're still
right, getting but you get some plus two gold. But, like, look, you're not paying seven gold.
To get plus two.
To get plus two. Like, I mean, look, I am not a Ryan Jones or a Greg Atkinson or... you know, level of, or, you know, or Corey. But, you know, I think I basically understand enough Thrones and card game logic that you're not going to play seven gold to get plus two gold. I could be wrong. You know, I'm not Hanno, but I think that that's not worth it, right? And so I think that that's where I find Haunting Accent frustrating. Like, I appreciate control attachments a lot, actually. Like, I like Strangler, I like Kraven, I like Milk, and I've defended Milk multiple times. But I think Haunting Accident goes one step too far. And that's not even talking about its interactions with Kohor, where you can just, even without paying gold, turn a sword into this. And that's, I think, too much.
I think a good chunk of this probably still goes back to hatred of Kohor and the ease at which it can turn these up, which speaks to Kohor more. But okay, I figured this would probably be one we came down on different sides on. I find Haunting Accident totally within the acceptable realm of stuff. If we're talking about I'm bouncing all over these Barra cards outside of kind of some of our usual scope, because if we're talking about kind of these NPE high risk, high reward type of cards, how about that, Sir Imre Florent, huh?
This is a weird card.
It is so weird.
It's not
so
weird as what's his name, though? Imre Florent? Kill him to choose an opponent you may sacrifice any number of locations for each location sacrifices.
opponent must choose a Neil Stating character he or she controls. Like, what the hell is that card? Like, it's just an action. Anyway, sorry. That's the weirdest card in this set. But
that's the card I said.
Oh, I thought you said the other one. Florent. Alistair Florent.
No. Sir yeah. Imri Florent. They're both Florents.
I heard Alistair. Yes. This card is weird. Like, what is up with this card? Like, when does killing your own character to do something positive? I guess that's technically a Baratheon because they have that weird glamour card. Yeah. I'm trying to...
I mean, that sort of made sense for the one, like, R'hllor effect that we, like, saw Melisandre do in the books. And this one, I suppose, is supposed to represent him and the Battle of the Blackwater and sacrificing all the ships, so to speak. I don't know. It's loose, but I see a direction here. But it is such a wild effect where it's you either this wins you the game,
which it frequently,
or it probably loses you the game.
I mean, I wouldn't say it loses you the game. I think there are definitely maybe it can turn a game, right? Yeah. Like
you don't have to be sacrificing like six locations to kneel out their whole board or something,
right?
Then, be down that tempo when he gets treacheried, but
well, yes, or gets red keeped.
Right.
More commonly at the end of the game. I definitely saw value plays with Emery Florent, right? Where it's like, turn five, I got some Rose Road sitting around. You kneel two of your dudes for my Rose Roads. And that's a pretty big tempo swing for a character that's like acceptable to just have in play. And it's just an action. So you can do it in one of those cleanup phases. And
dominance!
Yeah, no, Dom. No, you don't want to do it in stand.
I know.
But it's such a weird card. Like as you say, it squints and you see the theme, like the thematic connection. Because he does die, and your occasions represent your boats, right?
Yeah.
And this is the number of Lannisters that were killed by, I guess, the Baratheon side. Well, not even killed, but like I guess kept down.
Yeah, tied up, stalled, maybe?
Stalled, yeah. It's just such a weird card.
It is. It is super weird. Out of all of the, out of all the stuff in here that kind of expands the Bera color pie while still fitting, he is one of the most bizarre pieces of that, so... Like, I see how the pieces sort of fit, but it still just doesn't feel like a Thrones effect to me.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these, like, a lot of location, like, effects tend not to feel that Thronesy. Like, locations are a weird card type in Thrones, in general. But that's not worth going into right now. So, anything else stand out to you?
What else?
I wish Renly was better.
I mean, the big uniques, at least the brothers, are probably worth nodding at.
I wish that Control Robert was good. I wish he had been really good.
I saw games where he wound up being pretty strong.
Yeah, but he was getting that Barra Conclave deck.
And he saw a good bit of melee play, too.
Yeah, but... It's just hard to compete with the six and other seven cost Bobby.
Yeah. He had much stronger competition than say the Stannis here, which I really, really love. Obviously he didn't really have a beefy Stannis to compete with that saw a strong play, but he kinda has an interesting different effect with the immunity. Barra desperately needed some draw. He ties it into power challenges, but also in kind of this weird way where it keys off of claim, but not just your claim. So you could, like, it offers some neat ways to try and kind of punish your opponent for coming at you. And so I really like this Stannis. Out of all the brothers here, he's my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, he's also my favorite. He's also a fiddly templated card, right?
Yes. After you,
like... The claim value on the attacking players, so that means if you win one of the defense, it's a two-claim plot, you draw two cards.
is weird. Like,
I admit it's fiddly, but that's part of what I like about, like, trying to punish your opponent for coming at you and drawing off of their claim.
I love the top text line. Immune to opponent's events. Baby. Love it. Love to see it. Love to see it on a 7 drop.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Stannis is a card I would appreciate more with outside the context of sort of where he was most played. But he's a design I could appreciate. He's evocative of Stannis in the books.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, Renly just sucks. Like, well, not sucks. I just wish he was better, I guess, would be the thing. It's like, he's dangerous. Like, I get why he is at the power level he is. But I just wish Abera Renly was more played. Like, this is a card, this was in the Conclave deck. And it's a card that I hated. Because it was always a card that, when I actually was able to play him, he was pretty good. But then so frequently, he rotted in my hand as a 6 gold, 3 strength character that I didn't necessarily want to kneel my faction card to put a non-bearer character into play that's, you know, 3 cost or lower. Like, it's just because that's the way my hand... What I needed was, like, if I was going to pay 6 gold for something, I needed something more impactful than that, because maybe I only had bearer cards in my hand or something like that. Or I had Major Gorman in my hand and he's 4 cost. Something like that. Where, like, I appreciate what Renly's trying to do, but this is definitely a design that I think is a fun Shaga card. Like, it lands in the sense that, like, this Renly is much more Shaga.
Yes.
Than he kind of reads.
He definitely entices you to build an experiment in a very Shaga way.
Yeah. But he reads as a Jamie card, I think. But he's actually, I think, a more of a Shaga card.
And I'm okay with that, really. Yeah. Like, I want the box to have a mix of those types of effects. So he works for me in that context. Even if he's not the strongest from a strictly Jamie perspective.
Completely fair. Do you want to talk about the non-bearer cards?
Yeah. Well, we started to mention before recording that a lot of these are pretty blah. Lion Star definitely saw some play. She Bear saw some play.
Saw a lot of play.
That's about it, right?
I think the Dothraki cards also saw a play. Okay. Yeah. I mean, Dothraki Steed was busted in playtesting, and that's why it got the limp copy one per, it was, like, when you could put, like, 4-3 of these on Khal Drogo.
Right. Hold a piece, and, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. But Hago saw play. They're definitely not the strongest Dothraki cards, but they definitely saw play. But yeah, probably the best card is Lion Star, and, like, Lion Star's fine. Like, I think we reviewed it very highly.
Yeah.
And ended up being more of a role player than, like, a rehabilitation of the Lanny Jumpers archetype.
Well, I think to some extent at the time we were expecting the game to hit rotation. Wasn't this probably right about the time that Netrunner hit rotation?
I think, like, so, yeah.
I feel like when we were reviewing this, we were kind of expecting rotation and then this to kind of end up becoming the new sort of flagship jumper location. Flagship. I didn't even do that on purpose.
It does discard the character rather than kill it, too, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I, you know, like, Lion Star is a card that I was, like, never super impressed with, but it definitely, like, I know Lannister players came to appreciate it over time, but it never, like, stood out and screamed
must play. But it definitely, I mean, She-Bear is the card here that I think really saw a lot of play. Yeah. And then Chain These was a lot. And then the neutral cards also just didn't land, although...
Yeah. They're just really weird, though. I
Hollow Hill is
play Hollow Hill.
Busted. Yeah, Hollow Hill is busted.
Yeah, that there were a lot of Martell decks where I was like, oh, yeah, it's very easy for me to just forego loyal characters.
Yeah, and, you know, and then the Free Folk could also run it. I usually ran like one, I think. And Angry the Archer was also in those style decks. This was actually the neutral cards. These two neutral cards are quite good. You know, while it was also very strong in the Free Folk decks. I always thought he had stealth in my brain because he's so similar to the Stark one. So.
And I think he might have in first edition. So
he might have,
Might be kind of mixing some of that up.
I wish Unlikely Champion had the unlikely possibility of being really good, but that just ended up working out. Because it's definitely a card that feels like it just like, you know, we talked about this earlier when we reviewed the Tyrell box, right? It feels like this is a card that goes in the Tyrell Knights archetype because there's some good lords you want to play in that are also knights like... what's the oldest brother for the Tyrells? His name is escaping me.
Knight of Flowers? Loras?
No, Loras is the youngest.
Oh, you're right. Willis is older, isn't he?
Willis, and then the middle one, Garland. Like the four-cost Garland is good, and you can even run the six-cost, right? When for attacking alone, you discard a card, raise a claim. There's some good lords in the Tyrell one. There's some really good lords like Jaime in the Lannister Knight spell, too. You know, and there's... Marjorie, right, as well in the Tyrell build. But this card just didn't do anything, right? Like, even though theoretically it's a three-cost Tricon that creates that redundancy, particularly for the Tyrell deck, that it just ended up just not doing anything, even though it reads as, like, a huge enabler of Knight's decks.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't do anything is really what it boils down to. Not even that it didn't do anything for those decks. It's that it's just a like barely even French vanilla card. It needed something additional to that text rather than just gaining a power icon.
I mean, a 3-for-2 Tricon isn't like horrible.
Yeah, but like this late in the game life cycle, 3-for-2 neutral, so there's a good bit of effects that don't work on it. Only the knight stuff does. Like,
you're not wrong.
At if it was a 2-for-2, I think it would have seen play. Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is of course like one of those cards that right, like it is very hard to get the numbers right.
Right.
Right, because like if you went 2-for-1 Tricon, right, but because the difference between 2 and 3 gold on cheap non-unique characters in second edition is quite high, because of setup, and so
you know. The more you got me thinking about it, I think if it was 2-for-1 Tricon, I think I would have played it. I think that price point suddenly makes the knight interactions, particularly the stuff that needs a certain number of knights, makes him look much more attractive to trigger that sort of stuff.
Yeah. No, I mean, that might have been a direction to go, but again, might have been too powerful. So they definitely wanted to give you an enabler, but they tried to be cautious and... Classically, they were too cautious.
Indeed.
But I think there's nothing more that's worth talking about because we kind of at least obliquely hit upon most of the standout cards, even if we didn't specifically expend a lot of cards. Oh, actually, we were actually wrong. Although this is the weirdest Barra card, is a card that I think it also did this in first edition, Shira Errol. A card, like, do you know?
Oh, yeah, she was almost a reprint.
Right. Do you know who she is, Will, in the books?
Oh, no.
No one does.
I do not remember now.
No one does. Let's put her into the old Google machine. No, I don't remember her. Let's put her in the old Google machine.
I thought you had. Like,
she is the lady of Haystack Hall and head of House Errol. She supports Renly Baratheon during the War of the Five Kings. So currently, Prentnos acknowledges Lord Errol at the parley beneath Storm's End, and who supports Stannis Baratheon. Implying Shira has died before this event. In Dance of Dragons, Sebastian Errol has become Lord of Haystack Hall after Shira's death.
Oh. How'd she die?
That's the end. That is her extent. I just read the extent of her entry on Wiki of Ice and Fire.
Huh.
And she technically appears in Clash of Kings, so I guess she's at, like, Renly's feast or whatever. No, she appears in the appendix of A Clash of Kings.
Well, now I'm going to be dying to know.
That's her only appearance. And she's mentioned in the Haystack Hall entry of World of Ice and Fire. So. Huh. Very important card. I mean, look, George does not provide the designers with a lot of named female characters in every faction equally. So I definitely understand. But...
yeah. Sometimes I guess you just do what you gotta do.
Yep. Anyway, this is the weirdest card. Like,
weirdest because of the flavor thing or what she does?
What she does. Like, she's just useless. Like, the flavor thing is in combined with this. Like, what? She's like that Thorkost Arya.
Yeah.
That also sacrifices herself when you lose something else. Right? I mean, I guess this is when your opponent's characters are killed. You can also do this.
Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe it made more sense. I definitely remember her first edition version.
She had three power.
One X edition, play. Right? Yeah, yeah. She was 2 for 3 strength back then. So a little bit better in a challenge. And Baratheon, of course, being themed heavily as the Rush House at the time. The effect had a bit more application of, like, oh, shoot, my Robert died. Like, if I lose the, you know, 10 power I had on Robert... I'm back to square one. The game is basically over for me. Or, you know, I use Shira to try and stay in the game. But with that kind of big, go big or go home mentality not really being Barra's thing in this edition, she does feel more out of place.
Yeah, she was... better as like a blank card in first edition. Sorry, I had to bring her up, her first edition card up. Her first edition card said, after a character you controlled is killed, discard her from play to discard one power from the killed character, then move the remaining power from that character to another character you control. So
you lost a power back then. She keeps all of it now, though, right?
But it goes to your house card.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but she was a 2 for 3. But that's why I think you played this card.
Yeah.
2 for 3 strength. The icon you cared about is Baratheon. So I think the fact that we're just reading obscure first edition cards brings us to a unhappy end for this game.
Well,
for this set.
This box.
So overall, what would you say, Will?
Overall, not my favorite box. but not my least favorite. Somewhere middling. I don't know that I want to necessarily rank all of them right this second, but somewhere middling.
Well, I'll phrase it this way for our frequent listener. I know we have at least two listeners, Hanno and Sam.
Ooh, touche.
This is for our American listener, Sam. This is in... I would have said if you had asked me shortly after this box came out in... 2018, right, is when this came out? The end of 2018, I think. Might have been middle of 2019.
Yeah, I think it was like April or May 20.
Yeah, it might have been it was the release before Gen Con, because it was definitely legal in Gen Con.
Yeah.
Because some of these cards I think were played. This is a wet fart of a box. I really just don't like this box. And I would have said it's the most farty of all the boxes, except the Dragon box is then shortly thereafter. And the Targaryen box, I think, is just also, it suffers from a lot of the same problems, but worse. Because the power level of the individual cards is much higher. Like, there are some very busted cards in this, above all Azor Ahai, that just really limited what you could play in this game. Prince that was promised was also like that, but I'm willing to blame Greyjoy a little bit more than that agenda for those problems. But I would say I most dislike this box, but it gets overshadowed by the Dragon box. So we have that to look forward to in 2 weeks for the final set review.
Yeah.
Review or retrospective, whatever we want to call it.
Yeah. Something. I don't know. It's got half a dozen names, probably.
Yeah. But, I mean, it'll almost be a year by the time it comes out, right? I think I actually looked it up.
Yeah.
I think it was. Hold on. Let me give you 1 second. Let me scroll down to White Book in my phone. I looked it up because I was going to pull all the links for when we were done. Let's see. August. June 2020, June 6, 2020, we began our retrospective. So it ended in...
close.
Yeah, in end of April. So just about a year later.
Mm-hmm.
And that's with the winter break. So. All right.
Yeah.
Does that put us in the danger zone, Will?
Oh, I think that must.